Let's start with evangelism. The definition comes from the Greek word euangelion, which literally means good news. The Greek word eu is good. Legeo means to speak forth, means the word. So euangelion is the proclamation of a good word. This would go against what many Christians say today, that evangelism is incarnational, that it's you just live a good life and then people see Jesus in you. We're not going to say that evangelism is less than that, but it's definitely more than that, and it's essentially not that. Essentially, evangelism is the declaration of truth. It's a word. So think of an ancient person going throughout the land declaring peace with a native country or with a foreign country. It's a declaration of peace, a declaration of good news. Let's think biblically about evangelism. There's multiple different analogies which the Bible uses to describe evangelism. These aren't all of them, but there's some of them. It compares evangelism to farming, like Jesus says that the harvest is plentiful. How's he put it? Matthew 13, he gives the example of the soils, the multiple different soils, and he says this seed was this and that seed was that. No, the seed is the same. It's the soils that are different, the four soils. So why would the Bible compare evangelism to farming? It could be that farming is hard work. That could be a big lie that you buy into, that you think evangelism is just going to be simple, it's going to be easy. If it's anything like farming, there's going to be some work involved in this project of evangelism. The Bible compares evangelism to fishing. Jesus says, "You're a fisherman, I will make you fishers of men." That's worth reflecting upon as well. Why does the Bible use this illustration of fishing? For example, why didn't Jesus say, "I will make you hunters of men"? That would imbue a different sort of idea, wouldn't it? Hunting implies I'm coercively tackling people, you know, with the truth. I'm coercing them into believing. Fishing has a different idea, unless you're doing like dynamite fishing or spear fishing. That's not the kind of fishing they were doing. Fishing is you're throwing your line into the water and hoping to get a nibble, right? There, if you talk to expert fishermen, they definitely have strategy. They go to certain places and not others. They use certain kinds of bait. They go after certain kinds of fish, so on and so forth. But there is this imagery of we're casting out the line, hoping for a bite. It compares evangelism to warfare or to being a soldier. Soldier. Think of 2 Corinthians 10. The weapons of our warfare are not fleshly. They're spiritual. So it isn't in the sense that we're going in to kill the non-believing person. The imagery here is that we're destroying fortresses, anything that's raised up against the knowledge of God. Our battle isn't with flesh and blood. Our battle is with the principalities and the thought forms which the evil one uses to keep people from the truth. It also compares evangelism to being an ambassador. Think of what this would bring to your mind. Ambassadors go into a foreign country. When the ambassador speaks, it is as if the king or the chancellor or the president himself is speaking. You are fully representing your nation, your values, your politics, and everything else as the ambassador. And God says, we are his ambassadors. That when we speak, it's like we're speaking directly from him to lost people. With each of these illustrations or analogies, none of them are perfect, but one of the things you pick up on is the fact that there's our role and there's God's role. So farming, the farmer has a role. He has to go out and do something, and yet he can't look at the seed and tell it to grow, right? There was that YouTube video of that bodybuilder where he had, 80-pound weights, dumbbells, and his biceps were 19-inch biceps. And he was just looking at his arm, and he was just saying, "I command you, grow, grow!" And it was just so awesome. This guy's lifting just these stupid amounts of weights, but he's yelling at his muscle. And it's funny because, that's not how it works. You can't just command grow. There might be something similar happening here. You know, farmers, we do our part, and yet we trust that that growth is going to come. The harvest will come. Fishermen, same thing. It's like we got to put out multiple lines into the water, yet we're trusting that we're going to get some bites. Let's think about the biggest barrier to evangelism. If, like me, you like to traffic in Christian books, Christian podcasts, maybe even some Christian radio, you start to listen to a bunch of the pundits and a lot of the leaders and people talking about all the barriers in our culture. Why is it that evangelism has become so difficult here in the United States? Some people would say the biggest barrier is postmodernism, the worldview that started really in the 1960s, which believes that truth is conditional to culture, it's conditional to ethnicity, gender. And so when somebody comes in speaking about the truth, that's really saying more about the person, not about the external world of reality. Is that the biggest barrier? Maybe it's the moral decline that we've seen in our culture. Christians of all stripes are always pointing to some of these lurid stories that we read about, you know, mass shootings, killings, drugs, sex, rock and roll, whatever. You know, and you start to look at the culture, and you could argue our culture is getting worse. Yeah, I guess that is true. Morally speaking, materialism, it's just like everyone's so obsessed with their house, their stuff, their career. They're schooling, they don't have time, everyone's too busy. I mean, how many times do you hear, do you want to come check out a Bible study and somebody says, I'm too busy, real busy? Materialism, secularism. After 9/11, there was a shift in philosophical atheism, which went from, you know, atheists would argue that Christianity is false before 9/11. After 9/11, the new atheists, I'm thinking, of course, of Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and so forth, Christopher Hitchens, they took it a step further. They went from Christianity is false to Christianity is evil. And they started to use the word radical to describe any kind of religious faith. Richard Dawkins has the famous t-shirt, "Religion, together we will find a cure." And so that definitely has increased. You know, books like The God Delusion have sold in the millions, and people are lapping this up like never before. The rise of the nuns, not like Catholic nuns, but N-O-N-E-S, nuns. What's your religious affiliation? None. The rise of nuns has increased dramatically over the last couple decades. Where if you talk to like your grandparents or your parents, the baby boomers, everyone was involved in some kind of religion, and now that idea and identification with religion, that has dropped. Is this really the biggest barrier, I wonder? You know, for each one of these things, we can ask the question, well, what about the early church? The best authorities on this, I'm thinking, of course, of Kenneth LaTourette in his work on early church history, or David Barrett, who's an authority on a sociologist on the spread of Christianity. They place that at the year AD 100, the early church grew from 500 people to a million people. And I think they're right about that. It isn't as though there were a census or was a census taken. But we read the early reports and we see the Christians had made it into Bithynia, to Rome, you read Tacitus, he's early second century, he says that there is an innumerable multitude of Christians in Italy. Guys, this movement started in Jerusalem. They've made it into Rome, so much so that you have Claudius in the 40s AD, I mean, that's only 10 years later, kicking all of the Jews out of Rome because there were so many instigations over this person, Crestus, whom most historians believe to be is a misspelling of Christus, Christ. So the early church blew up. I mean, it just spread like wildfire across the known world. Well, they didn't have postmodernism. Sort of. I mean, they had pluralism. You know, it was not illegal to worship Jesus in the first century. Did you know that? You could worship Jesus. Second century, Roman Empire, not illegal. Third century, not illegal. What was illegal, what became an illegal religion, was to worship Jesus only. Christians drew incredible fire that, you know, you were invited out to a party where they were going to worship the god Zeus, and you wouldn't participate because you didn't believe Zeus existed. They went so far as to call the early Christians atheists because they said, you don't believe in any of our gods, the local deities, tribal deities. They had pluralism and they were punished for it. They were killed for it, not being pluralistic. Moral decline. Have you read about the first century world? Way worse than today. I bet Paul, if he was alive today listening to Christian radio and talking about the moral degradation of this culture, he'd be like, way better than when I served in the first century world. Infanticide, abortion, fornication, everything. I mean, it was just all permissible. We have that note from that one source, 1 BC, where it says that the man put his child out to be taken by the wolves. Hilarion, I think is his name. And he says, if it's a boy, keep it. If it's a girl, leave her exposed. It isn't that he viewed it. It's not like he was a cold-hearted man. He refers to the child as like, I love that child. I just want to have a boy. Girls, subhuman. Don't care. They're dog food. So moral decline, I don't know. I would say we've had moral progress since then. That can't be our problem. Materialism, yeah, I mean, I guess so. But in the first century world, it was, you know, trying to survive. So in many ways, they were working more than we are today. They seem to be able to have no problem reaching people. Secularism. Well, what about the Chinese or African churches? Many authorities say that 30,000 Chinese people come to Christ per day. Per day. Africa went from 2% Christian to 50% Christian in a century. There's more Christians in Uganda than there are, more Presbyterians in Uganda than in the entire United States. I mean, they don't seem to be having a problem. I would argue that the biggest barrier to evangelism is not the culture. The biggest barrier is us. The biggest barrier is our unbelief in the power of God to reach people through us being instruments of Him, putting ourselves before Him. Reflect on your own spiritual history. How is it that you came to Christ? I remember for years I was kind of freaked out over the fact, what if I hadn't been sitting outside Oxley Library at that time when I bumped into my friend who eventually led me to Christ? I was out there smoking a cigarette. I was reading my Ernest Hemingway for class. I had my box of Marlboro Reds and my lighter. And my buddy came over and he said, well, my future buddy, he came over and he said, can I borrow your lighter? I said, sure. So I gave it to him. Then we started to talk. Bada boom, bada bing. Checked out my first Bible study. He led me to Christ. And I've started to think about that. What if I just, instead of having the lighter and the pack of cigarettes on the table, what if I had that in my pocket instead? We would have never met. I would have never come to Christ. Was that just like a big coincidence? Is that what that was? I don't think so. I don't think that was a coincidence. I think God was behind that. Not behind me smoking, but I think He was behind that. You know, sometimes we talk about divine appointments, where God sends people. Randy Newman, who is the author of the book Questioning Evangelism, which is not being skeptical of evangelism. It's a method. You raise questions. I told my buddy, you should read Questioning Evangelism. And he kind of looked kind of perturbed and walked away. And then a week later, he's like, I thought you were suggesting that because I was questioning whether evangelism is a good thing. And that's what the book was about. It's like, no, it's about asking good questions. Anyways, that's a rabbit trail. Randy Newman, when he came to speak here, he was working on his PhD. And for his thesis, he was interviewing people that had come to Christ as adults. And he said it was blowing him away. He would ask people, so how did you come to Christ? And they would tell their story. He told the story of this one woman. She was in her 30s. She said, I came to Christ at age 17. He said, how? She said, well, I didn't grow up in a religious home. I never read the Bible before. My parents weren't church. They never taught me that. But one summer, I was taking a three-week trip to Ireland, and I was packing up my stuff, and I put my Bible in my book bag. And Newman said, whoa, 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 whoa. You put your Bible? I thought you weren't churched. Well, no, I wasn't. Where'd you get a Bible? I don't know. I guess I got it when I was six. Somebody gave it to me. Who gave it to you? Don't remember. You put your Bible? You were taking a trip to Ireland? Why'd you put your Bible in your book bag? I don't know. Not sure. Not sure? Not sure. Huh, was it like a small Bible? No, it's like one of those really big Bibles. You were a 17-year-old girl taking a trip over to Europe, and you decided to put your big Bible in your carry-on. Why? I don't know. So you got over there. Yeah, I got over there, and it wasn't that great, and my friends were rejecting me, and I was sitting there, and so I pulled out my Bible and started reading the Gospel of John. Wait. Why? Why? What prompted you to do that? Huh, I don't know. Not sure. You're not sure? No, not sure. He tells the story of his wife coming to Christ, where there was this magician. I don't mean like an occult practicing magician, but just a dude. He was a very popular magician who had become a Christian. And he was working with Campus Crusade, which is now called the Campus Crew for obvious reasons. But he went out there and he was doing a magic act for all these students on campus, and it was awesome. And the magician at the end of it, he said, okay, if you want to stick around, I want to tell you about something that happened in history that I can't explain through some kind of a subterfuge or sleight of hand, something I actually think was a true miracle. What I'm doing here is, you know, sleight of hand and stuff, but I want to show you something that's actually something I can't explain besides a miracle. And of course, he was talking about the resurrection. So Randy Newman's wife was there, and she was listening to this, and all of her friends were there, and they said, oh, here we go. Here comes the Jesus pitch. So all of her friends got up to leave and walked out of the room, the auditorium, and they said, are you coming? And she said, no, I'm going to stick around. And he said, why? Why did you stay? She said, I don't know. She said, I've always been kind of a follower, especially at that time. I was always giving in to peer pressure, and for some reason, I could not move. I stayed there. I listened to him talk. She came to Christ. So I just want you to think about that. You know, was it all a big coincidence? Was it all just some kind of cosmic coincidence that you came to Christ? The answer is resolutely no. God himself was seeking you, brought you to know Christ through people. So what do you think is at the heart of being effective in sharing your faith? Again, there's a number of different, there's been hundreds of books written on this topic, how to share your faith, strategies, questions, approaches, philosophies. Here's the answer I think is the most important. 2 Corinthians 5:15, Jesus died for all, therefore, from now on, we recognize no one according to the flesh. Do you see what that's saying? It's, as a believer, I know that Jesus died for every single person. And so instead of viewing them as an outsider, instead of viewing them in a caricatured, self-righteous way, I start to realize I can't recognize them according to the flesh. This is someone for whom Christ died. I remember sitting in class my final semester of Ohio State. There was this kid in the classroom with me. I just have to admit, publicly confess, this guy was so obnoxious. I hated the way he talked. I hated what he talked about. He had this annoying little laugh. You know, just every time we would do discussion, it was global studies class, it was lots of discussion. I just always was on the other side of the aisle from him, you know, philosophically speaking. Every opinion he had was wrong. Every opinion I had was right. You know, one of those kind of feelings. And I remember at one point in the class just looking at him, and every time he'd open his mouth, I would just cringe, like one of those kind of people. And I remember having the thought, you know, I wonder how much someone would have to pay me to be that guy's friend. You ever wondered that? Like really be his friend, like for the rest of your life, how much would it cost? And I was like, 100 million, 10 million. I don't know. Like, I don't even want to be around him. It's hard just to be polite. And then it was in the middle of class. I remember thinking about this. I felt like God spoke to me and he said, you know, I not only would go without payment for being that guy's friend, but actually I gave up my son and I've been waiting for that guy right there since the moment he was born to turn to me so that I could have him in my family. It was one of those moments where you felt like, whoa, recognizing people according to the flesh, assuming people aren't interested, assuming I couldn't care for them. Verse 20, so we are Christ's ambassadors. God is making his appeal through us. I know you guys sitting out here, you know what this is like. I'm sure you've been there where you've been speaking to your friend about Christ. You ever had one of those moments where you felt like God just took over? It's like God was in your heart, was in your mouth, was in your head, speaking. How does Paul put it? We speak for Christ when we plead, come back to God. The plea of the heart for the lost person. Spurgeon was someone who had led thousands to Christ. He said, when I preach, I don't preach as though I never tell people I'm pleading with you. Instead, I just plead with them. I cry out. He said, I talk as if they were on the gallows pole and I had to convince the judge to let them be acquitted. The plea of the heart. Or think of this outrageous statement from Romans chapter 9. Outrageous. You want to talk about a Bible difficulty? This is the hardest passage in the Bible for me to fathom. Paul says, my heart is filled with bitter sorrow and unending grief for my people, my Jewish brothers and sisters. I would be willing to be forever accursed, cut off from Christ, if that would save them. Have you ever felt that way for a lost person? I would be willing to go to hell so that they could go. I'm going to be blatantly honest, never, never have I felt that way. Maybe for my kids, okay? Maybe. We sometimes wonder, you know, what was it about the Apostle Paul? How could he walk into a city and within a month or two he had formed such a deep love relationship? Why were people drawn to him? It's because he had this kind of a heart for people. That when he thought about people, they weren't just projects. They weren't just, well, I guess I'll share my faith today. He cared for them. He had the heart of Jesus Christ. The willingness. Now, I don't know if that's hyperbole. I don't know. But if it's hyperbole, it's hyperbolic of something. It's hyperbolic of a heart that is just broken for lost people. Jesus had this too. Why is it the people were flocking to Jesus? Matthew 9:35, Jesus was going through all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. There's the proclamation of the gospel. And yet, even with all that teaching ministry and that healing ministry, verse 36, seeing the people, he felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited like a sheep without a shepherd. You never want to get to the place where when you're sharing your faith, when you're teaching, you're preaching, you're working for people, you lose that sense of compassion that you feel for them. Luke 19:41, when he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city and he wept over it. To really feel the weight of people who don't know the hope of Jesus Christ and to weep over that. You know, Jesus wept when? He wept at the tomb of Lazarus and he wept over lost people. So, what is at the heart of being effective in sharing our faith? It seems to me that the answer to the question is in the question itself. That we would have the heart of God we would have his heart, and that we would pray for it, that God, I want to have your heart. I want to have your eyes to see people the way you see them. Lord, I'm recognizing people according to the flesh. Would you put that heart in me that I could care for people the way that you do? And you know, tonight we're going to discuss what it looks like to, you know, have some practical training and so on and so forth. But really, if we skip over this part, this is going to be an exercise in futility. Pray we can have God's heart. In fact, I brought this clip. This clip is from David Geisler. Do you recognize that name? He's Norman Geisler's son. So Mr. Philosophy, Mr. Truth, Mr. Apologetics, Norm Geisler. And his son is kind of wired the same way. His son's really into apologetics, really truth-based, really academically oriented, and so forth. And I thought this was an interesting clip because he's talking about sharing his faith, and he has this to say.
I want to close by telling you a story. It's a true story. To make a very important point that I don't ever want you to forget. You see, 2.5 years ago, before we moved back, when we were moving back from Singapore to the U.S., just before we did that, we got a call from my wife, who's Chinese, from her aunt. You see, her uncle was in the hospital, and he was dying of cancer. He had terminal cancer. He'd been smoking all his life. And the doctors only gave him 2 weeks to live. And I had tried to witness to him so many times during those 7 years. And I had one more chance to talk to him before he passed away. And so when I saw him in the hospital, I said a number of things to my wife's uncle. But the most important thing I said to him was this. I said, "Uncle, when I get to heaven, I want to see you. I want to see you." Now the sad thing is, he didn't accept Christ that day. And the following week, I was in Taiwan doing some training, and I found out he died. And I was very sad. But then I found out that his sister, who is a Christian, talked to him 2 days later. And this time he did pray to receive Christ before he died. And when I got back, she called me to thank me. Because here's what she told me. She said part of his reason for why he made that decision is because of my tears for him. See, sometimes it's not even what we say to people that makes a difference. It's our tears. It's our heart for the lost that will make the difference. Let's close in a word of prayer.
So I thought that was pretty powerful. He's not a, he doesn't strike me as a real emotional man, but he has stories about how, you know, he just leads one college student to Christ after another. And I've heard him, you know, actually he's got video of, you know, talking to students and stuff, and you can tell the way he talks to them, it gives him so much dignity. He doesn't try and play gotcha, you know, talking people into a corner and then, oh, that's wrong and so forth. Definitely has a heart for people. We see the same thing in Francis Schaeffer. This is from his book. He is there. He's not silent. And this just always struck me as a new believer. I remember finding out about Francis Schaeffer and just reading voluminous amounts of Schaeffer. Just love Schaeffer. He's such a smart thinker and passionate and everything else. And yet he would just switch between talking about philosophy and theology and apologetics into the heart. His heart for people. So he's got this quote from He Is There, He's Not Silent. He says, "Modern man is left either as a machine with words that do not lead either to values or facts, but only to words." He's talking about the despair of pluralism, postmodernism, before it was really even a thing. He says, "Or he is left in a world without categories in regard to human values. Moral values are the difference between reality and fantasy." And then I remember this stuck out to me. He just says, "Weep for our generation." You could tell it's like we've got the truth and it hasn't turned into a self-righteous thing. It's that our heart is broken over people. This comes up throughout his writing, Genesis and Space and Time. He says, do not be proud. As you look across the world of sinners, weep for them. He's always talking about weeping. And Schaefer, there was a story that was told. He was speaking out at one of these big conferences, 5,000 people. And he's supposed to speak at 7 o'clock, and 6 o'clock came and went, 6:30 came and went, 7 came and went. Finally, he races in there by 7:15. They said, where were you? He said, I was at my hotel, and I started to talk to the lady who was cleaning the room about the Lord. Didn't you know you had a conference to speak at? And it, to him, it was like, that person matters. The guy who led me to Christ, he was supposed to go to class when we first met. And I remember him saying, I got class at 2:30. And I remember 2:30 came and went, 3 o'clock came and went. We went to class together at 4. And that stuck out to me. This guy cares. He's into hanging out together. This shouldn't be a thing where, I hope you don't misunderstand me, or I hope you do understand me. This shouldn't be a thing where we're generating tears. We're manufacturing something that isn't there. It's that we would have the heart of God and that we could show that. I don't know if it's going to be through crying or just through a sincerity of heart, but people would pick up on it.